The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Our guest this week is Dr. Richard M. Salzman, president of Intermarket Forecasting, Inc. Dr. Salzman is also an assistant professor of political economy at Duke University, a senior fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research, and a senior scholar at the Atlas Society. He earned a BA in economics from Bowdoin College, an MA in economics from New York University, and a PhD in political economy from Duke University. Dr. Salzman is the author of numerous books, chapters, and articles, including Breaking the Banks, Central Banking Problems, and Free Banking Solutions, Golden Liberty, Where Have All the Capitalists Gone, Essays in Moral Political Economy, and many others. For more information, please visit richardsalzman.com. So welcome to the show, Richard.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Jay. It's great. Thank you.
Well, Richard, critical race theory is undermining the entire United States in every possible way. I'm sure the founding fathers are turning over in their graves with regard to the lies that are being put forth by people pushing a critical race theory. All of our listeners certainly have by now heard the term critical race theory, but few of them fully understand it. And in this coming hour, I think all of them will become well acquainted with it and therefore be able to battle it with their friends and neighbors who also have heard it but don't understand it. So let us hear a very short summary of how you would define critical race theory and why it's really all about racism and how it relates directly to racism.
Well, racism itself and any ism, if you go to the root race, this is an unchosen character trait when you think about it. This is not something we choose. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. However defined, whether genetics, whether ethnicity, whether lineage, hereditary, all those kind of things, skin color, pigmentation, when you think about all those things, they are not the same thing as a religion, a philosophy, a career choice. The race we have, we are born into, we have no choice over. So that's the first thing. Now, what is the ism of it? The ism of it is to take that and judge people based on that morally. Now, you see immediately the problem with that. I don't have a choice over these traits, so why are you judging me for good or ill on these traits? Why wouldn't you instead judge me on what I have choice over? The things I think, the things I say, the things I do. So that's one aspect of it, that is racism. And, you know, years ago, more than 50 years ago, when Martin Luther King was becoming active, Ayn Rand wrote an essay on racism, which was quite interesting because it's so prophetic as well. If it's okay with you guys, I just want to quote from it. She says, puts it in a broader context, then we can see what CRT is doing. So this is from one of her essays, quote, she says, racism is the lowest, most crudely primitive form of collectivism. It's the notion of ascribing moral, social, or political significance to a man's genetic lineage. It's mm-hmm. the notion that our intellectual and characterological traits are produced and transmitted by internal body chemistry. which means in practice, she says, that a man is to be judged not by his own character and actions, but by the characters and actions of a collective of his ancestors. It claims that the content of our mind, not our cognitive apparatus, but its content is inherited, that our convictions, values, and character are determined before we're born. And she finishes out just one more quote. This is hilarious. This is the caveman's version of the doctrine of innate ideas, of inherited knowledge, which has been thoroughly refuted by philosophy and science. So racism, quote, is a doctrine of, by, and for brutes. It's a barnyard or stock farm version of collectivism appropriate to the mentality that differentiates between various breeds of animals, but not between animals and men, unquote. So that's just some of the basics. She goes on to talk about determinism, and that's my point about determinism is the idea that you have no free will. And so racism is also deterministic in the sense that it doesn't allow for, you know, regardless of your lineage, that you have free will and you choose to think, you know, according to reason or not. The critics will, you know, often, I remember when Clarence Thomas was being put up for the Supreme Court, you started hearing language like, he's thinking white. I mean, it's really disgusting when you think about it, right? If Clarence Thomas does not, you know, mimic and bow down to the standard views of other black men, then he isn't seen as an individual worth listening to, you know, might have a different view. He's literally racially attacked. By the way, but critical, you asked about critical race theory. Okay, so if that's what racism is, the purported aim and motive, as they say it, of critical race theorists is to be anti-racist. That's what they claim. And they're actually racist. It is bizarre. It is literally upside down as much is in the world today, completely upside down. First of all, it's not new. This is about 30 years old. So critical race theory was developed roughly in the 90s. And here's probably the most controversial thing I'll tell you guys today. It arose precisely because America was making such great progress on race. It couldn't stand to see America actually eradicating racism. So the standard view is that critical race theories are all over the place because America's, you know, getting worse and worse, or whatever its terrible background, it hasn't improved. I think it's the other way around completely. And I think actually the election of Obama, which really totally, not the only thing, refutes the idea that America is fundamentally or institutionally racist, also bothered them. I mean, it really bothered them. He won twice. And to them, they want to portray America as terrible. They're really not anti-racist. And the critical part, we can talk about this more, I don't want to monologue. The critical part, by the way, comes from Marxism. So we can talk about that as well. But the idea in Marx classically in the mid-1800s was there is a battle, an inherent battle between capital and labor, between employer and employed. And literally within 50 years, those Marxists realized they were wrong. The capitalism did not do that. The capitalism was improving the lot and the standards of living of the workers. And they got worried. Instead of simply concluding that they were wrong, they got worried and started shifting toward other possible conflicts. Black versus white, man versus woman, straight versus gay. It goes on, human versus the planet. There is an untold number of alleged struggles and conflicts that what's called cultural Marxism has tried to push, literally and simply for purposes of getting rid of capitalism. So the CRT people are basically just part of a group trying to rid the world of capitalism, but in a way using America's benevolence and, if you want to call it, trailing guilt for what happened in the 1800s with race and slavery, mm-hmm. to make them overthrow capitalism. But I want to stop there because there's so much yeah. here.
Why did they want to overthrow capitalism?
Well, for standard reasons that they think it's unjust, they think it's unfair, they think it creates inequality. You know, actually, it reflects normal inequalities between people in their capacities, interests, and career choices, and things. Mm-hmm. So whatever reason a typical anti-capitalist would be, anti-capitalist, they are. And so in that regard, I don't know, CRT could be thought of as a tactic for going at capitalism in another direction. Now, let me give you a quick quote on this. Kendi, Ibram X. Kendi, who's written a book called How to Be an Anti-Racist, and he is the most prominent voice, not the only one, but out there, that has a professor's position somewhere. So his book is How to Be an Anti-Racist. Here's an excerpt. Capitalism is essentially racist. Racism is essentially capitalist. They were birthed together from the same unnatural causes, and they shall one day die together. Notice the hope there, that's the kind of mark, from unnatural causes. That's interesting. On racial or racial capitalism will live into another epoch of theft and rapacious inequity, especially if activists naively fight the conjoined twins independently as if they're not the same. A similar passage in that book goes on and on about why he used the word anti-capitalist, and there's just a litany of wrongs allegedly done by capitalism. And this is in a book on how to be an anti-racist. So that's really the method here. The method is to salvage the lost reputation of Marx's theory of capitalist exploitation and decline and shift it to cultural exploitation and decline and hope to get away with it. But he does say, if it's true, as he says, that capitalism is essentially racist and racism is essentially capitalist, to be anti-racist is to be anti-capitalist. You've got to get rid of the system.
Would it be beneficial, Richard, if all our listeners explain to their friends that this is really a ploy of Marxism and communism to overthrow everything our country stands for? Would they take it more seriously if we dug down and let them understand the root of this, that it really isn't about black versus white? It is about communism versus capitalism and the effort to overthrow the government, and that the critical race theory is just a front, a false facade of what is going on.
You know, I think that has some value, but I wouldn't rely on that, frankly, entirely. You guys know, and I know, and I have a really high regard for Chris Rufo, who has exposed CRT and has argued this, mostly from this perspective, which I myself brought up Marx. But if you say to people what you just said, they might interpret it as, McCarthyism or something, or a simplicity of approach that says, forget CRT. You don't really understand that. It's just dressed up Marxism. So let's remind you how much you hate Marxism and socialism, and hope that saves the case. I think it's worth, maybe a 2-3-pronged approach. One of them would be to make this connection, because they make it themselves. It's not like we're foisting this on them. The founders of BLM said the same thing. Patricia Kalores and others said, we are heavily trained Marxists. She said, that's what we were trained to do. We're Marxists. This is BLM. What's that got to do with Marxism? Because it's anti-capitalism. It's a Trojan horse. But I think it is actually really worth also going at it from a standpoint of what we're doing here today. What is race? What is racism? And let's take them on their word. It is called critical race theory. So what is their theory? Their theory is you cannot be non-racist. Funny thing about this is they almost indict themselves. They say in their passages, everyone's a racist. Kendi actually says at one point, I forget what the passage is, but the line is shocking. The reason I hate white people is, quote, 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 it just says, I hate white people. Now, that's just racist, to hate people because of their skin color. I mean, not I hate Hitler because he did X. I hate white people. I realized when I was 12 or 13, and I really hated white people for whatever the reason. I forget what the reason was. There's no real reason. But again, there's that determinism, right, that people cannot be colorblind. That's another way of putting it. No, that's a lie. In fact, they argue that if you say you're colorblind or could be, that's a sign that you're racist. You just don't know it. You're in denial. It's like climate denial or Holocaust denier. How they love to classify deniers. So that's, you know, racist. And as Kendi actually says, you can't ever classify yourself as non-racist. You must be anti-racist, which means you must go out of your way to allegedly fight racism. But what it leads to is literally an obsession and a preoccupation with race, which is why when you look today, wow, race is everywhere. Apparently racism is everywhere. That's their point. That's part of their goal. They want you to think it's everywhere. And mm-hmm. actually, the only people who would think that way are racists. When you see someone who says and refers to color, brown, black, with every other sentence, I mean, that's not the only evidence, but that's part of the evidence that that person themselves is a racist. They are so obsessed with judging people on skin color. And here's the psychological projection of it. Being convinced that others must be equally obsessed. I myself cannot be only obsessed with this. It must be everyone else in the world who's also obsessed. That will make me feel a little less guilty that I'm actually a racist.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're debating, I think.
I've heard it said that, according to CRT, only white people can be racist. Is that correct?
Some of them say that, but others say it's possible to anyone. I find that they're mixed on that issue. By the way, I mean, I love bringing in capitalism because, to be clear, I mean, that is my main specialty. But the phrase racial capitalism, well, obviously, that'd be something I'd pay attention to, is all over the place. And it's of the kind Kendi was talking about. And they have to bring that up because, as I said, I think their ultimate motive is anti-capitalist. And so the idea of racial capitalism, wedding the two and then say, well, if you're against racism, you need to be against capitalism, to the idea. But let me give you a quote from a book on CRT, an introductory. And this is more than just capitalism. And this is really kind of shocking. So this is Delgado and Stefancic. You've probably heard these names. Richard Delgado and Gene Stefancic wrote a book called Critical Race Theory, An Introduction. See, this is it. They're advocates of it, and they explain it. And, you don't need to make this stuff up. You only need to quote them. Now, listen to this quote. This is literally page 3, right up front. I'm quoting, unlike traditional civil rights, which embraces incrementalism and step-by-step progress, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law, unquote. Now, the liberal order literally means liberty. So they're saying CRT questions the foundations of liberty. And then what do they mean by equality theory? Equality theory is the idea from the Declaration, all men are created equal, and it didn't mean physiologically, it meant they should be treated similarly before the law, right? Equality before the law, that's inscribed over the building, over the Supreme Court. They're against that, therefore equity. And equity is equality of result. So when you hear the word equity, and they say, well, we at CRT, equality is not enough. We need equity. And their literal method is to look at what's called disparate effects. So Kendi will say something like, suppose blacks are 13% of the population. However, they're only, 2% of CEOs. Therefore, racism. That's it. That is literally the approach. Now, if you said to him, well, blacks are only 13% of the population, but they're 94% of NBA players. Mm-hmm. Is that anti-racism? That's disparate effect. See what I mean by disparate effect? They look at these distributions.
That's funny. My son, I got to jump in when you talk about the NBA.
Yeah.
My son and I, watching basketball forever, we always thought that every basketball team, college or professional, should be required to have a white player on the floor at all time. I mean, it was a joke. We just laughed about it, but it's as ridiculous as all the reverse. Let's talk about how they used the founding fathers, some of which held slaves. How have they used that in hurting our nation by proclaiming us all as racist?
Well, the first approach or the first step would be to back it up 150 years and claim that the United States began in 1619. So that's what the 1619 project is at the New York Times. Now, 1619 designates, I believe it's the first slave that stepped on soil here in North America, although there was obviously slavery within in certain Indian tribes as well. And slavery, of course, is thousands of years old. I mean, it at least dates back to the Egyptians and the pharaohs and those who built, were forced to build the pyramids. And by the way, not simply racial, I mean, Slav itself, the Slavic people coming from slave, they weren't black, they were white or mixed. So the idea of humans owning other humans and telling them what to do is really, really very old. So part of the CRT lie is to basically drop all that context and to hone in on a picture in time that renders a particular group that they truly hate, the founders of America. Why do they hate the founders of America? Because they hate America. Why do they hate America? Because it's quintessentially capitalist. I mean, that is literally the quote-unquote logic that they're working with. And now, why wouldn't they call it the 1776 Project? Well, because precisely that was when the U.S. broke with Britain, and not to criticize Britain here, it was Britain and America during the Enlightenment century. Remember, they hate the Enlightenment, the era of reason overcoming prejudice and superstition. Britain got rid of slavery before the U.S. did in the 1830s. And did it without a civil war. But to America's great credit, it got rid of slavery by the way, 600,000 or 700,000 white men fighting to end it. But the truth, call it the half-truth, and what they're saying is, yes, some of the founders were racist. And some of the founders owned slaves. And some of the founders either condoned, defended, or apologized for slavery. Now, notice I said some. One of their tricks is to say all founders. It's not true. The Federalists, led by Hamilton, were anti-slavery. And the Jeffersonians, sadly to say, tended to be racist and or slavers. So the real cleave in the American founding is, call it the Hamiltonians versus the Jeffersonians, or the Federalists versus the they called themselves Democratic Republicans at the time. Hamilton, who worked closely with Washington during the war, tried to get Washington to enlist and enroll blacks in the fight, and Washington resisted. Washington was kind of straddled the fence on this. So this is also a problem because the Constitution of the United States itself, as even Frederick Douglass admitted later, is a fundamentally anti-slavery document. It does not condone or perpetuate slavery. In fact, it had provisions that put a fuse at the end of it. One of them, by the way, was, it literally says in the Constitution, in 20 years, you have to end the importation of slaves. Now that calculated out to come out to be 1808, funny enough, during Jefferson's presidency. So why did they do that? You know, their view was, step by step, unless you stop the inflow of slaves, you're not even going to begin to get rid of slavery, but let's stop at least the slave trade. And then other provisions were attempted. And of course, the abolition movement in the U.S., mostly from the North, mostly from the Hamiltonian areas, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, started abolition societies in the 1830s. So it wasn't just the beginning of the Civil War that put an end to this. It was it was arguments for anti-racism. A really proud, I think America should really be very proud of this lineage, especially the Republican side. The Republican Party itself, I don't know if you know this, was founded on that one issue, get rid of slavery, 1854. And Lincoln, of course, its first famous candidate. And, you know, after the Civil War itself, an amazing effort to basically vanquish the feudalistic, racist South was basically vanquished by what? The free labor capitalist North. So the whole idea of capitalism and racism, I mean, America's Civil War showed that capitalism extinguished feudalism. It wasn't feudalism that extinguished capitalism. It wasn't the old South that beat the new North. It was the new North, a very capitalist North, a very Hamiltonian urban North that beat the South. And then I'll just leave it at this, the three amendments right after the war, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, 13th, getting rid of slavery, 14th, making sure this Bill of Rights applied to all the states, not just the federal government. And then the 15th, with the right of blacks to vote. Blacks got the right to vote in the 15th Amendment prior to women getting the right to vote, which was the 1920. I would find the CRT people much more credible if they were to make these distinctions, which are, you know, in the history. They're there. We're not making these up. But in other words, the context of slavery and America's role in it, and America's eradicating it, the difference between the founders on slavery and racism, the difference between the two parties, Republican and Democrat, on this issue. So they'd be a lot more credible if they do that, but they lump them all together because they really do want to condemn America and indirectly capitalism.
Yeah, I understand. Well, just before we go to our break, can you talk about whether America is systemically, institutionally, structurally, genetically racist? You know, Obama said it's in our DNA. I mean, does that even make sense? Is America systemically racist?
I would say no, it's not. And by all those words, what it really means is it in the Constitution? Is it in the laws? And then, not to get too legalist about it, is it in the kind of the moral character of people? I would say that at one time, yes, since slavery existed prior to the Civil War, but in a very small part of the country, in terms of sheer number, too, I'm not just talking about the geography of the South. Anything that was allowing it, you could say was part of the, quote, system. But the idea that it's eradicated, it really means it's not structural. It means the structure was either changed, and so it really cannot be claimed any longer. I don't really think it can be claimed after the Civil War, but if you want to be more precise about it, the Democrats after the Civil War, after the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, trying to resist the results of the Civil War by creating Jim Crow laws in the South, segregation laws. They still have the KKK as their paramilitary arm. These are the Democrats, not the Republicans. And so they were trying to retain the structure of racism that had gone all the way back to the Jeffersonians. That's why MLK and the 1960s civil rights movement had some truth to it. It was like the last vestiges of racism structurally in the South. And, you know, MLK himself, I believe, was a registered Republican. And he gave his talk not at the Jefferson Memorial, but at the Lincoln Memorial. Very, very symbolic. MLK knew what he was talking about. CRT people reject MLK. They ridicule his phrase about we should be judging people on the content of their character, not on the color of their skin. The CRT people would get that. Their view is that's impossible. It's especially impossible to white people.
Richard, in the second part, we're about to go to break. You know, I want to talk about the veracity or lack of it of everything they put forth, and also talk about their desire for reparations for sins committed against them centuries ago. I think that would be a good place to start after our break.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. Are you looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator of nutritional supplements for cell health. Most vitamins haven't been upgraded since the 1930s. Healthy Cell uses an innovative technology, which is a gel pack that provides a better absorbed vitamins and nutrients where they're needed the most. I just took a Healthy Cell today before I went out and exercised, and I can tell you I am working hard for America Out Loud Radio as we speak. And tonight I am looking for good REM sleep. And I can tell you I am tired and I want to fall asleep, stay asleep, and sleep deeply and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell. You're going to use the Healthy Cell REM Sleep Supplement. This is the only sleep supplement designed to support all four stages of sleep. So go to healthycell.com, and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, and get a 20% off for your first order of any product. I use Healthy Sal, and I'm really glad that I've been introduced to it. So I recommend it for you. Again, go to healthysal.com and use the OUTLOUD code, promotional code, for a 20% off your first order. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Richard, before we get to my question about whether there should be reparations and the fact that they want reparations for crimes against Black people committed centuries ago, I've noticed something among all of the CRT woke liberal types, that they not only hate America, they hate white people. I actually believe they hate themselves. I find there is no joy among them. I've yet to meet any of them, and I've talked to many that are upbeat and joyful in any aspect of their life. And I wonder if there's a psychological aspect to this that makes them be who they are and be promoting actually the undermining of our nation.
Well, I think that's really a profound insight. I'm no psychologist, but you can observe what you just described. And by the way, I also observe it, I think you have as well, among environmentalists. There's a certain asceticism, there's a certain religious medievalism, hair shirts, self-flagellation involved. And yet it's something I do know for fact, there's such a thing as projection. I mean, actually, I think it was Freud who identified the idea of projection, meaning you know what your own thoughts and feelings are. Suppose you're embarrassed about them. Suppose they're racist. Suppose they're, hatred for, wealth, or suppose it's envy. I envy those who are succeeding more than me. You don't really want to publicly display that. So what do? You accuse others of it. You accuse others of it. It makes you feel good because for that moment, you aren't any of those bad things. I think that does happen. There's another way of looking at this. The C in CRT, critical, accusatory, condemnatory, critique. This actually goes way back. This is not all that new. Immanuel Kant, philosopher from the 1780s, wrote a book called A Critique of Pure Reason. Kant was anti-reason. Kant was bothered by the Enlightenment. And so I believe the kind of thing you're talking about really comes down to something like this. If you're constructive, not destructive, if you're proposing and advocating something or creating something, say in business or science, there is a certain uplift, there's a certain optimism, there's a certain benevolence, there's a certain all those good things in your character. Where on the other hand, if you look around you and say, I hate stuff around me. I want to tear down, critique, destroy, undermine, overthrow, revolt. You see all those things. I think that tends to go with a more negative personality. And now, if I were to tell you I'm critical of CRT, well, I am. I, Richard Salzman, am critical of socialism, critical of communism. I might be accused of the same thing, right? Although Salzman's harboring certain hatred for. But the reason I hate those things is I classify them as inhuman. I'm a humanist. I'm someone who wants humans to not only survive, but thrive, you know, not only to live, but to flourish and be happy. And I can see that not all humans are benevolent. Some are really misanthropes. Some of them are really misanthropes. They really do hate. It's the only species, by the way, that does this. You can't find any animal species that turns in on itself, you know, that some of them are good, but some of them want to kill all the others in the same species. Mm-hmm. And you get the mass murderers in history. So that's too long-winded an answer to your question, but I think it's a really profound.
Well, I know Tom has a question. Tom has a question, but before he asks it, I want to throw in an amusing thing that happened to me at a Christmas party last year. I was sitting around at a table of eight people and chatting with someone on the absolute other side of the table who was quite conservative, and we were talking about something conservative, and I made the statement that, like I said earlier, I've never met an upbeat, happy-go-lucky liberal. And a woman next to me stood up and started screaming at me that she was a happy, upbeat liberal. And everybody at the table fell out of their chairs laughing as she had proved my point.
That's amazing. You know, if you go back to the 1600s, a whole group of my ancestors were killed by natives in the Bronx. This was Anne Hutchison, actually, and her family. I was fortunately descended from the son who stayed in Boston, who wasn't killed with the rest of them. And, you know, it sort of makes you wonder, I mean, should I be demanding a public policy of reparations for what happened in the 1600s? And people would say, well, of course not. Well, but yet that seems to be part of the CRT idea, is that there should be some sort of social justice based on what happened in the past. Do you think that's even a legitimate criterion?
Not in the least. Now, the concept itself, by the way, restitution, reparations. I mean, the civil court system today deals with this, right? Civil versus criminal matters. Someone harms you, someone harms your property, you go to court, you prove material effect, and you get paid. So the concept itself, this is where the half-truth is involved. The concept itself of repairing a wrong is not the problem. The problem is that it's collectivized. And notice this relates back to racism, which Ayn Rand said, I agree, is a collectivist approach to things. This is a collectivist approach to justice. It's not a one-on-one X violated Y, so Y deserves payment. These are groups. These are not only broad groups. They're, as you said, over hundreds of years of time, they're not even related groups anymore, certainly not on an individual level. So to me, that is the essence of injustice, to make someone pay for something their ancestors did, or to pay someone who doesn't deserve it because they themselves weren't wrong, which is what reparations would require today, is actually the height of injustice. Now, they use the term, as you may know, not just here in reparations theory, but in other things, social justice. And you might ask, wait a minute, what happened to good plain old justice? Why does it need to be social justice? The social justice approach is, as racism is to say, how do groups treat each other, not how do individuals treat each other? And there's this either collective guilt or thing going on. And tying it back to Marxism, I do believe that one of the motivations for the reparations approach is not to rectify past wrongs, but to massively redistribute wealth. And that's what Marxism, of course, said. Marx said, the capitalist wealth and profits are stolen. They're stolen from underpaid labor. And the demand of the Communist Manifesto of 1848 was expropriate the expropriators. So reparations is that in this racial context. Now, It's interesting, when the U.S. was becoming more abolitionist in the 1830s, there were actually plans offered to pay to release blacks. In other words, someone said, well, if we can't get the Jeffersonians and the ones in the South to surrender their slaves, maybe we can raise money and pay them because they're claiming it's property. So the abolitionist, now some abolitionists said, no way, because I'm not going to concede that they're property. And if they're not property, I'm not going to pay Jefferson for his slaves. So, but just the idea, though, that some kind of reparations might be paid, and Britain did this to some degree, actually. But you have to do it in a context where the people are still alive, you know. And by the way, Reagan did this. Reagan, and I think in 1984, signed a reparations bill regarding FDR's incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. Now, why was that okay? I thought that was okay, actually. Because many of the descendants were still alive. Mm-hmm. And many of the Japanese descendants who had been wronged were still alive. Now, you know, to be true justice, you would have had just the Democrats pay for that. But Reagan had the entire country pay for it. But those are the kind of principles, I think, that are relevant to this question. You have to specify the guilty and the victims and the perpetrators, so to speak, and have the reparations go that way. And if it can't be done, then it's an actual act of injustice to do this.
Well, I'm old enough to have well remembered the incarceration of the Japanese, and I have to say, when Reagan did that, I cheered myself. But as a scientist, I've got a dilly of a question to ask you, which I really do not understand, that CRT rejects objectivity, rationality, logic, grammar, math, and they call those things racist. And my entire career as a scientist are based on those things. And I don't understand how they make that connection or have any success in selling it to the public that does not understand critical race theory at all?
That's a really good question. The fact is true that they do reject all these things that are basically part of scientific method, and not just in the hard sciences, but in the social sciences, rationality, objectivity, logic, grammar, empirics should matter in economics, politics, and psychology as well. I would put it this way. If you think of those principles, they're part of the Enlightenment. They're all part of the Enlightenment. These are not values that would have been prized in medieval times. And, you know, instead of reason, it would have been faith. Instead of logic, it would have been revelation. So that connects back to our earlier discussion to the extent, and I think it's a great extent, CRT is anti-Enlightenment. I quoted Delgado on that. They're also going to be against the constituents of Enlightenment thinking, which is objectivity, rationality, logic, these kind of things. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is, not to complicate the discussion too much, but CRT doesn't simply get fuel from disappointed Marxism, what I call disappointed Marxism, the Marxists who couldn't find labor being exploited, so they look for other clashes and see them everywhere. They also are fueled by something called postmodernism. And in this context, modern means the Enlightenment, and pre-modern means the medieval religious period, and post-modernism means something that will come after our current capitalistic, scientific, modern era. And so they're not quite medievalists, but these are professors, and they themselves have been around for 30 years. The post-moderns, they're called, or POMOs, are universally anti-capitalist. And this, if anything, just shows the power of philosophy. They're anti-capitalist because they're anti-Enlightenment. And they're anti-Enlightenment because they're anti-objectivity, rationality, logic, grammar, and all those other things. So CRT does rely on that. You know, so when you said, how can it so brazenly come out against objectivity, rationality, logic? Because in the background, for many decades, the POMOs have been teaching students who go out into the world that there is no such thing as objectivity. That your opinion is no better than my opinion, that, you know, what is reason, but, you know, emotion, you know, taking over, logic, you know, there's many logics, there's bourgeois logic, and there's black logic, and there's women logic, and you know how it goes. And so that would be my answer to how can they be rejecting these seemingly great traits. These are traits from the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment's under attack.
Mm-hmm. That sounds to me like something which would really threaten the very fundamentals of our modern world if it actually succeeds.
Yes. I mean, on the racist part of it, by the way, the reason they would go all racist here is they would say, well, these are traits that white males practice, and we hate white males. You know, the standard view, which is so wrong, they'll say something like, not just these guys, but, you know, women are the feeling gender and men are the thinking gender. You know, men are rational and women are emotional and things like that. So even on gender grounds, this idea that women can't be rational, objective, logic is just ridiculous. I mean, that's sexism, not racism. But same thing on the racial side, the CRT will be against those things because they'll look out on the world and they'll say, well, I see objectivity, rationality, logic, science, Nobel Prizes. I see them largely going to white people. So these prizes aren't really earned and these methods aren't really legitimate. They're just racist. They're just something that white people have imposed. And by the way, if they see a young black kid, you know, doing homework, reading, doing experiments at the lab, they basically tell him, stop acting white. It's outrageous. It's really outrageous.
Well, I am, as the resident optimist here, I'm actually seeing all of this being attached to the Democratic Party that really has gone over the edge. In my knowledge, the Democratic Party has been the party of true racism, slavery, segregation, Jim Crow laws, the KKK. So I'm sort of glad that they're tying this weight to them. In fact, I'm happy to see all the terrible things that they are doing. They're out in the open now, totally. This administration is virtually a criminal administration, and every week they're doing something that damages the normal citizen, and it's going to come back to bite them in November of 2022. The midterm election really is going to be a poll of the people of how much they dislike what is going on, and I'm very confident that the Republicans will swamp the House, take a very large majority, and I even have a feeling of something really exciting that's going to happen. I think Mr. Trump is going to run for the House of Representatives in Florida and win, and in January of 2023 become the Speaker of the House. A lot of people laugh at me when I say that, but actually I'm very confident. And so to an extent that all the wokeism and the critical race theory and the 1619 project, all of this is going to sink them, and there's a brighter future. Any opinion on my wild optimism, Richard?
Well, you know, I hope I don't have all the particulars that you do there at Trump and stuff like that, but certainly I hope that that's the case. But the public schools are just rife with this stuff, and it isn't just the public schools anymore. You're recounting, by the way, of the American Democratic Party and that sordid history. It's true, but how many people know that? I mean, if blacks vote 80% for Democrats, that's a head scratcher, because that means they either do not know that they're voting for the party of racism. And I mean this by history, but I think also in current terms, there's a kind of hidden racism dominant to that party and not to the Republican Party, frankly. That's a head scratcher. And many, I hate to use colors here, but many whites don't know this history either. So that's one thing, but it's relevant because, by the way, CRT is pushing back saying, wait a minute, why are you criticizing us? All we're doing is talking about America's racial past. Well, I would hope that would be the case, but the idea here is not to whitewash, no pun intended, America's racial past. But if you really taught America's racial past, you would say, wow, the Democratic Party is largely responsible for all this crap. So why are CRT people Democrats? It's amazing. Why is MSNBC and all these others dominantly Democrat? Do they not know the history? They did not simply start improving with MLK. And now the fact that they reject MLK is all the more proof that they possibly haven't changed their stripes at all since the Civil War. Not at all. Mm-hmm. By the way, just to make a pitch for deeper ideas and philosophy, and I know you guys are interested in that, I often get asked, why is it everywhere now? So suppose we were talking 20 years ago and I said, well, this kind of woke stuff is in the universities and maybe a little bit in Hollywood and maybe a little bit in journalism. Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, but now it's there plus in business suites, in corporate CEOs, in the Pentagon, right? Heather McDonald writing recently, in classical music, in concert halls. They're throwing out the canon because so many of the composers were white. This is actually a sign that it's philosophical, you know, that it goes to the deep core, this attack on enlightenment ideas, objectivity, individualism, capitalism. It is precisely because they're striking at the root that it's going into all the limbs and branches of the tree. If you saw it confined to only one or two areas, you would say, well, it's a kooky thing, but it's not really philosophical. This one's philosophical. It truly is, and that's the way to fight it.
So what's the best way to fight back against critical race theory?
Yeah, I think the best way is to recognize and inform yourself on these deeper philosophic issues, not hacking away at just leaves or acorns way out on the branch. You know, for example, someone, I won't name them because I actually admire them, said, well, the way to fight back against CRT is to put cameras in the classroom, you know, a public school, to document how bad these CRT teachers are. You know, that to me, that is really hacking away at a result of a deeper problem. It has to be a philosophic and cultural, if you will, and historic. Yeah, you need to know the history as well, attack on CRT. And you can say provocative and yet true things like CRT is active precisely because America has made so much progress on race. I mean, those kind of things just make people's head turn. Like, what? Wait, I thought they were the anti-racists. No, they're obsessed with race, and they really do not. They're worried, just as the Marxists were worried 100 years ago that the workers weren't going to revolt. The CRT people are very worried that there won't be a race war. They're worried that the Americans would vote for Obama. They're worried, you know what I'm saying? They're actually worried that MLK existed. They're worried that we're not structurally racist. That is bizarre to most people, but that's one way of going at it, I think.
In our last 3 minutes or 4 minutes, can you talk a little bit about what you do at Duke University and Atlas Society? In particular, what's this philosophy, politics, and economics program?
Well, it's a great program at Duke, and there are other what they call PP&E programs, but Duke is a leader in it. My colleague Mike Munger started it in 2006. PP&E stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Okay, so they're all part of the social sciences, but the theory of it is students need a more well-rounded learning environment. And if they only study philosophy, you know, there are philosophy majors, politics majors, economics majors. The idea is that these three disciplines interweaved, intersected, make it give you a much more comprehensive and factual sense of how the world works. It's been very successful. The students flock to it. It's a way to kind of turbocharge their major. They get great jobs with these PP&E program certificate. And so I'm loving it. It's hard to find professors who can teach all three and relate to three. But the fact that these programs exist make people study it more. There are journals associated with it. So it's just a fabulous program, and I love it. Now, at the Atlas Society, which I joined recently, the Atlas Society has been around since 1990. It was founded by philosophy professor David Kelly, my colleagues over there, Stephen Hicks and Jason Hill, professors also. They're promoting learning of the ideas of Ayn Rand, who authored The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And, you know, to me is one of the better philosophic advocates of capitalism. She wrote this book called Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, 60 years ago or so. So I do a number of things for them. It's a part-time job, so to speak, but one of them is a webinar called Morals and Markets, which has been very great. It's basically college students. I started off with Duke students, but others have joined. And we take 90 minutes once a month on the fourth Thursday. At night, I give some topic. I speak for maybe 20 minutes, and then we open it up to debate and discussion. You don't have to be a fan of Ayn Rand to join in. It's interesting how it evolved, because I've had students who come through my courses or go through Duke, and then they move on into the world, and they're asking for recommendation letters and things like that, and I try to help them in their career. And many of them would want to stay in touch and, you know, recreate the kind of seminar experience we had at Duke. So I started Morals and Markets for that reason, and it's just taken off at Atlas Societies.
Are there any audio or video opportunities that our listeners might be able to tie into? Because philosophy, politics, and economics just sounds like a brilliant idea. I wish I lived near near Duke that I could jump into and listen.
The best way to do this is through Atlas Society. So if you just go to atlassociety.org and then go to my Morals and Markets subpage, it's really under education. There's a whole page devoted to PP&E because one of the sessions was devoted to that. So I had readings on PP&E. So that's the best way to get it instead of going straight to Duke. Although you could put in Duke PP&E. If you just search Duke PP&E, you'll find a page at Duke explaining the programs, and you could tell your kids about it. So,
yeah, well, I can tell you, Richard, sincerely, I'm going to go there because you have just been an amazing guest, and I know our listeners are going to absolutely thrive on what they've learned in this past hour.
Great. Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you guys. You ask great questions. I think I talked a little too much, but I get excited about these things. They really matter. Ideas really matter, don't they, for good or ill? And I love America. I love this country. It is lots of reasons to be proud of it. I'm an unvarnished capitalist. And we can see the assaults, whether it's from postmodern, CRT, environmentalists. But capitalism, in my recent book, I have a whole chapter on all the ways to be anti-capitalist, and I have like 10 or 12 of them. It's a little daunting. So the book is called Where Have All the Capitalists Gone? Just came out this month. But it's another way of saying, you know, capitalism has very few friends and many enemies. But the enemies tend to share the same kind of premise, namely, to hell with reason, to hell with self-interest, to heck with individualism, constitutional government. Once you see the commonalities, they're easily defeated. They all fall in the same camp, and in that regard are easier to take on.
Yeah. Well, that was wonderful, Richard. And I encourage our listeners to visit richardsalzman.com to look at all of Richard's books and his other activities. So once again, that was our guest, Dr. Richard M. Salzman. And this is Dr. Jay Lear and Tom Harris signing out from the other side of the story.